On this week's 51%, suicide rates among female veterans are rising.
And so I thought my struggle was just mine, but I didn't realize until years later that every veteran, but especially female veterans, go through that free fall.
Hear about so-called John School, and a Rwandan woman shares her escape from genocide. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%.
When you think you've had to.
Leaving the military often face different psychological issues compared with men, and when those issues are not addressed, the results can be tragic. In the first of two stories, Jay Price reports on an alarming rise in the number of suicides among female veterans.
Leaving the close-knit world of your military unit can be stressful, especially when you're carrying extra baggage. Retired Army Colonel Ellen Herring is Director of Research at the Service Women's Action Network, or SWAN. Last year, her advocacy group surveyed thousands of military women on mental health issues.
I was shocked that 60% of the participants said they'd been clinically diagnosed with depression, and about 50% said they had been clinically diagnosed with some sort of post-traumatic stress type injury.
Dina Martorello Orellana is part of another startling statistic. Female veterans are nearly 2.5 times more likely than their civilian counterparts to kill themselves. Laurel Martorella is her mother.
She was beautiful. Smart kid. Really smart.
Beautiful, smart, and something more. Dina was that girl, the junior high school soccer whiz who made the boys on the field seem frozen in place. So athletic that watching one of her games then or later in high school or college could make you just stop and savor the sheer wonder of human potential.
She excelled at anything she tried.
And eventually, she tried the Marines. In 2010, she deployed to combat-torn Helmand province in Afghanistan with the small female teams that were attached to male infantry units to work with the Afghan women and children they encountered. When Dina came back, something had changed.
The only thing she ever really said was, "I don't see the world like I used to anymore."
Dina's sister Robin says whatever the problem was had to do with something Dina saw or experienced involving Afghan children.
She said that she could handle everything except for the kids, and I don't know what that means.
In 2013, her rental home burned down, and a man she knew was charged with arson. She loved being a Marine, but decided to leave the service in 2015 when her enlistment ended. But problems began piling up. She'd been living with a boyfriend, but moved out. She was charged with driving drunk, then charged again.
Dina was very much a perfectionist, and I think that in her eyes, her life was just failing now.
On March 4th, 2016, Dina went to the VA for help. Her mother says VA officials told her later that Dina agreed to counseling. Then Dina asked a friend to drop her at the house where she'd lived with her boyfriend, who wasn't home. She went in the bedroom and retrieved a .45 caliber handgun. She sat on the floor and leaned against a wall. That's how Dina was found.
She wrote a note.
But not a real note.
You know, "I'm sorry. Just call 911. Take care of the dogs. Don't come in the bedroom."
A VA official later told her family that Dina had PTSD related to combat, which she had never even told them she'd experienced, and from the house fire.
I can't fully blame the VA because the military members aren't taught how to be able to ask for help when it's time, and therefore the VA system is unable to provide said help because neither side is connecting.
Ellen Herring, the research expert, has studied the effects of serving in the tiny women's teams in combat zones like Dina did. It's just one thing that can make women's experiences in the military different.
So they returned to units, didn't know where they'd been, exactly what they had been doing, what kind of experiences they'd had. They couldn't kind of hash through traumatic events that they'd been through together because they didn't have anybody else there who'd been through it.
In Dina's hometown in western Pennsylvania, Dina's family has started a small foundation in her name. It gives scholarships to high-achieving girls and brings more attention to military suicide. So they're keeping her memory alive in the classrooms where she did so well and on all those soccer fields where Dina was so alive. I'm Jay Price, reporting.
And in the second story, we hear about the number of female veterans has been growing rapidly, but leaving the military can create different psychological challenges for women. Mental health experts have been focusing more on female troops' transition to the civilian world. Jay Price reports.
Hi, how are you?
This recent after-work gathering in Charlotte resembles those held by any number of veterans groups.
So we talked last week about balance. We're going to talk about stressful relief today.
But as it convenes, one difference is obvious.
Everybody has the same foundation. Okay, you're all females.
A crucial difference, says Army veteran Joy Cook.
So no matter what we're talking about, whether it's a relationship or whether it's the kids or whether everybody has that same base of going, oh, yeah, I know.
These meetings are only for female veterans, and they've been occurring over the past few weeks all over the country, thanks to a grant from Walmart and with support from the VA. The idea behind the Women Veteran Network, or WOVEN, is to build a gender-specific support system. Human connections are crucial for mental health, and especially when women are just getting out of the service, says Air Force veteran Kat Corchado, who's leading the meeting.
The military really made it seem like all you do is this and this and this and this. You need LinkedIn, and you'll be good. And so I got out of the military thinking I had this pat. I was good.
But once out, she didn't feel linked into any sort of support.
You get into this free fall, and you don't know how to climb back out of it. And so I thought my struggle was just mine. But I didn't realize until years later that every veteran, but especially female veterans, go through that free fall.
She says women vets deal with obvious stresses from wartime deployments and shifting out of the predictable, regimented world of the military. But Corchado said they may also have other pressures that are more common for women, like being a single parent, as she was when she moved back into civilian life.
Not only do they have to find a job, they have to find schools that, you know, support their kids. And then they're doing everything for their family that, you know, two parents would normally do, so that's difficult.
There are a host of such pressures that are more likely for female veterans. Retired Army Colonel Ellen Herring is research director for the advocacy group Service Women's Action Network.
Women have increased risk factors that men probably don't face.
Risk factors that increase the likelihood of problems like homelessness, unemployment, and depression, and contribute to a suicide rate among female veterans that's nearly 2.5 times greater than among civilian women.
They're more likely to have been assaulted. Certainly, they've been harassed. They're more likely to be single and have children. They have a struggle getting jobs at equivalent pay that their male counterparts do. Those are huge financial burdens and challenges.
And the cumulative effect can be that free fall Corchado talked about. VA experts on women's mental health say the transition to the civilian world has long been a priority, but the VA and Pentagon are focusing on it even more. They'll be co-hosting a workshop in August for some of their healthcare workers. Transitioning out and suicide prevention will be central topics. Herring's group also has ideas.
A recommendation was do assessments. Make sure the assessments take into account the possible differences in the experiences between men and women. And then let people know where they stand with an assessment. If you've got some mental wellness challenges, okay, what do I do about it? Who can help me with it?
That's among half a dozen recommendations on the mental health needs of service women and veterans that her group plans to make to Congress, healthcare providers, and veterans groups. She says the results wouldn't just help women. By focusing more on specific issues by gender, male veterans would have better results with their transitions, too. This is Jay Price reporting.
This story was produced by the American Homefront Project, a public media collaboration that reports on American military life and veterans. In central Ohio, law enforcement has seen an increase in sex trafficking, likely due to the opioid epidemic. The demand for this work is driven by men who seek sex, and while criminal justice plays a big role in curbing that demand, reporter Esther Honig of Side Effects Public Media inquires whether education or punishment is more effective.
It's a dreary Saturday morning at the downtown courthouse. A group of around 20 men sit in a conference room, arms crossed, eyes staring blankly at the presenter.
But I know you guys don't want to be here. This is probably the last thing you want to be doing on a Saturday morning. I completely get that.
This is John School. Everyone here was caught purchasing sex. Some were ordered here while others chose to come in exchange for a lighter sentence.
Coercion. What do you guys think coercion might be?
Many of these students believed that women enjoy sex work, but what they're learning is that the majority are forced into it as victims of human trafficking.
So, hello everyone. My name is Jen. I have 2.5 years sober.
Jen Glasser was driven to sex work by an opioid addiction.
How I got started, my son's father introduced me to heroin, went through everything. I lost my home. I lost my son. I had nothing. The only way I could make money was to prostitute.
Eventually, she was trafficked by a man she thought was her boyfriend and nearly died before she managed to escape.
If you're out there looking for love, it's not going to happen. Because, you know, I told you I loved you. I told you I'd marry you. I told you anything you wanted to hear just so I can get that money. That's all you got. That's all it was about.
At least a few men in this room appear to really be listening. And the idea is that this will discourage them from ever buying sex again. Some studies show John School works. Others say it's inconclusive. Policy expert Alex Trudeau says what's been proven is the shame and embarrassment of getting arrested. That alone reduces recidivism by 70%.
So in my mind, anything else you get on top of that with a John School or a fine or whatever is gravy. The key is, are you actually making the arrest?
But making the arrest takes time and resources. Ron Kimmerling is the commander of the Vice Unit with Columbus Police. And to catch sex buyers, he sets up what are called reverse stings out of hotels and out on the streets. A female officer poses as a prostitute while several more officers stand by as backup.
If you go out there, you'll see these guys circling the block. They're like a shark. It's patently obvious what they're doing. The people in the neighborhood know what they're doing.
It's a labor-intense job. Kimmerling points out the cost of these operations may be greater than the penalty. Columbus laws allow a fine up to $1,000 and 30 days in jail, but few men do any time. An analysis of court records by Side Effects shows that in the last 2 years, the average for fines was around $70.
Myself, speaking personally, I wonder about priorities when a traffic fine costs more than picking up a woman for sex in Columbus.
Kimmerling and advocates think a harsher penalty will discourage men from doing this in the first place. A state lawmaker has introduced a bill that would increase the fine to $2,000, with half of the money going to help victims of sex trafficking. Alex Trudeau says how the fine gets used is more important than the amount. If it goes towards a fund to help victims, judges are more likely to impose it. And it holds the sex buyer accountable.
You know, there's just a long history in our country of finding ways to excuse men who buy sex illegally.
Of course, those with the most at stake here are the victims. Another survivor, Valerie, asked that we not use her full name. She thinks John School alone is the most effective solution.
I think it's a sickness. I think that they're spiritually bankrupt. And yeah, they got a hole and they need to, they're looking to fill it somehow. There's underlying issues with this.
If this is their chance to reflect and learn from their mistakes, Valerie's hoping they'll take it. For Side Effects Public Media, I'm Esther Honig.
The story was produced by Side Effects Public Media, a reporting collaborative focused on public health. Ibrahima Mazerwa is a survivor of the 1994 Rwandan genocide. Her escape as a mother of four and pregnant at the time inspired her to create a nonprofit to help other refugees and their children. She shared her struggles and successes with Versify, a show where people tell their stories and then a writer turns their words into poetry. Joshua Moore takes us into a conversation between Mazerwa and poet Destiny Birdsong.
Before the war broke, Abriley and her family lived in the capital city of Kigali. She worked as an accountant, her husband wrote for a state magazine, and they had a comfortable life. But in April of 1994, that all came to a devastating end. As violence spread across the city, Abreli says it became dangerous to so much as leave the house. And the risks were particularly high for women.
In war times, women are raped, women are mistreated, women are taken advantage of.
She knows well the challenges that women and mothers faced. After one of her close friends was murdered, O'Brielly decided to adopt the woman's 4-year-old daughter, even though they already had several children of their own.
And the war broke when I had 4, and the fourth was a baby, and the fifth was a pregnancy. So you can imagine how much that burden was on me. I felt like the world was ending on us, especially when you see killers, you know, brushing their machetes. It's one thing to that just goes through your mind and you feel like, oh, I'm dead. I'm gone.
Because they wanted to keep their children safe, O'Brielly and her husband stayed trapped inside for weeks at a time, and that made it even harder to find adequate food, compounding the difficulty of O'Brielly's pregnancy.
What I can tell you is God protected us in a way we would not have ever imagined.
There's one moment that stands out. It was in the rainy season.
I remember we were running away. We wanted to go to the hiding at a Catholic school close by.
But the rain was pouring down, too hard for them to attempt an escape.
Now, we learned after that on that day, that's when the UN peacekeepers left. And the killers went in and killed every person. So those are all the things you really have no control over. God has worked those miracles around us.
Why we will never forget April 1994. I could smell the rain before I heard it, pounding the roof in double time like militiamen or like the baby kicking my stomach, empty as a soccer ball. I dreamed of fields green during times of peace, of children racing toward goalposts, now stacked with bodies. I would bid my oldest to cover their eyes whenever we passed them, but today we were trapped indoors, so much water. I thought the sky would collapse and the world would end like it should have. Everything in my body was ruled by water. My son's amniotic sac, the sweat pouring in rivulets down my back as the killers dashed into houses on our street. And then, when a bomb exploded nearby, my tears would fall into my daughter's hair as the men ran for cover. They thought their own lives precious. But then there was April, and there was a Catholic church, a safe haven just up the road. But the rain kept us huddled beneath our roof. My husband, always our rock, his face like a stone. The day of the storm, the peacekeepers left, and men entered the house of my God, killing everyone, while I gathered each of my breathing children under the cathedral of my skirt and prayed. Here's what I know. There are machetes and there are miracles. There are difficult pregnancies, and there are deliveries. There are saviors, yes, and then there is God moving on the roof as we wait out the rain. Thank you.
As Destiny Birdsong finished delivering her poem live on stage as part of the city's International Women's Day, the entire audience seemed genuinely moved. It was clear that the exchange between storyteller and poet had had an effect on both sides of the microphone. From Nashville Public Radio, I'm Joshua Moore.
Versify Podcast is a partnership between Nashville's public radio station WPLN and The Porch, a nonprofit writing center, along with PRX. Asian American women are expected to be submissive and quiet. The Funny Asian Women Collective with a K, also known as FAWK, F-A-W-K, is out to change that and get big laughs. KFAI's Dixie Trichel produced this profile of the group.
There are perceptions of what type of content or what type of art making Asian women are supposed to create.
We started this because we wanted to create a space where Asian women could tell their stories on their own terms without being censored. And so that's what FAWK is.
At some point in the audience, you feel like, well, I'm going to throw out a topic. for us to just see what these ladies will say. We're not on topic. So
the founders are Mei Li Yang, Naomi Ko, and Sai Mukta Dongpusai Bongsai.
Hi, my name is Naomi Ko, and I am a member of Fok Funny Asian Women Collective. I actually am a comedic storyteller, and I also do film and television. Wrote and produce and star in a TV pilot called Nice. I was invited to do a show in St. Paul, and the curator asked me if I wouldn't swear and if I could keep it basically PG. And the type of comedy and the type of performance that I do is actually pretty inappropriate. I swear a lot. I talk about sex. So that night, I bombed. And we had to do something about it. Otherwise, you know, this wasn't going to be a great career for me. Asian Pacific Islander women, American women, are expected to act a certain way. We're expected to be submissive. We're expected to be quiet. And we're expected not to swear or be aggressive or abrasive. We really want to change that concept, so that's why we started this group.
My name is Sai Mukta Vongsai, and I am a poet, a playwright, a culture producer, a teaching artist, also the managing director of the Funny Asian Women Collective. We are a unapologetic group of Asian Pacific Islander American women. Our mission right now is to use comedy and performance art to clap back at microaggressions. FOC does workshops as well as cabaret performances. So the workshops are open to anyone who identifies as APIA and a woman. It's our way of creating safer spaces for us to tell our stories. And the cabarets are open to everyone. But we insist that people are mature when they come because some of the content might be out there, which we're not going to apologize for.
My name is Mei Li Yang. I am a writer, performance artist, and teaching artist. A lot of Asian women experience microaggressions almost every day. I had a boss once who said, "You're really high functioning." That was meant to be a compliment. So there are things that people say all the time. Sometimes they're meant to be offensive. Sometimes they're not. A lot of times they're meant to be jokes. And what happens is that sometimes we're not equipped to speak back. So we just thought, okay, let's create a space where people can practice talking back and speaking up for themselves.
My name is Sophia Eck, and I participated in a FOC improv workshop. It's just a fantastic way to get in a space where you can practice learning how to respond to a situation that might make you uncomfortable, but in a safe space where you're being coached.
Our guest is Atsuko Akatsuka. If I liked this song, I'd be proud of it. I'd be like, that's called chopsticks. But because I don't like the song, I call racism on that. You know, that's how it works.
I think in a way we are mentors because Mei Mooks and I are all Minneapolis, St. Paul, Minnesota-based comedic artists. There's really no one else who looks like us who's doing what we're doing. We believe we're doing a twofold. We're building the next community of APIA women, female identifying comedic talent, but then also we're trying to arm the community with ways to cope and to deal with microaggressions.
Again, this piece was produced by KFAI's Dixie Trichel. And if you think you heard about Mei Li Yang before, you did. We brought you a piece solely about her in show number 1505. The New York Stock Exchange, for the first time in its 226-year history, will be led by a woman. Stacey Cunningham, who started her career as a floor clerk on the New York Stock Exchange trading floor, is the 67th president of the big board. That means that two of the world's most well-known exchanges will be led by women. Adina Friedman became CEO of NASDAQ in early 2017. Cunningham, who was the chief operating officer for the New York Stock Exchange Group, succeeds Thomas Farley, who left to head a special purpose acquisition company. In April, it was announced that the Fearless Girl statue, which has become a global symbol of female business prowess, will be moved from her spot staring down Wall Street's bronze Charging Bull to a new home facing the New York Stock Exchange. And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1506.